Sex Bob-omb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine of this soon, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Hello, everybody out there in After Rot Land. Welcome to another amazing episode of Stuff and Stuff and Stuff. Tonight we have a guest, JG Fierty. How's it going, JG?
Good, good. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. We can talk about stuff and stuff and other stuff. So, you're an author of horror stuff.
Yes, I am.
But don't go anything about Pokemon just because somebody mentioned it in the chat room.
I don't pay attention to it at all.
Good plan.
Yeah. Horror, science fiction, fantasy. I do a little bit of all of it, but mostly the horror and dark fiction.
Excellent. Because who cares about the rest? Well, I care about the rest of the stuff as well, because... Hey, I just noticed something. You had something published in Graveside Tales.
Yes.
I knew that.
That was a while ago. That was my first novel.
Sorry, I didn't mean to just go straight to that, but that was a group and a company. We're still friends with the guy. It was like weird. Sorry, I off-tracked. My bad. So yes, you are a horror author, a number of different books there. Tell us a little bit about some of them.
Let's see. We mentioned Carnival of Fear. That was my first novel. That came out in 2010. And since then, I've had Cemetery Club, The Burning Time, Ghosts of Coronado Bay, and last year, The Cure.
Cool. And I see a whole buttload of short stories.
More than 50 plus 9 novellas.
Nice. And how? I mean, obviously, you're doing well with that. Is it a thing that's picking up for you? I mean, I've personally seen horror, you know, as a genre doing better, but how's it doing for you as a person, as an author?
I think it's definitely picking up steam. There's when you're first starting off, people always say, "Oh my God, look at that person! There's a bestseller over there. His first novel did this or that." And they don't realize, you know, there were so many novels and short stories and everything else before that. It's something that has to grow. You know, it gains momentum, and I feel like I'm doing that, so I'm happy.
Cool. So it's like the overnight sensation that took several years to get there.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's always a good spiel to go with people. It's like, what do you mean he just came out of nowhere? It's like, no, he's been doing this stuff for a while. What do you want? Yeah, I get a kick out of that on all sorts of different things that people do, music, books, writing, etc. It's like, no, they've been working for a while. So cool. So let's talk about horror then for a little bit. What is it about horror that attracts you to writing in that genre?
Oh, geez. I don't think I could even say. I mean, other than the fact that since I was old enough to remember, horror is what I love to read. It's what I love to watch. So I think it's just natural that I gravitated toward it.
Cool. What would you say some of your influences were as a younger feller looking and reading and doing stuffs?
Influences that got me, I guess, interested in the genre in general. I was reading, you know, Stoker and Poe and Shelley and that sort of thing. God, as a little kid, I probably like every pre-teenage boy, I went through all the Hardy Boy books, which, you know, back then were a combination of mystery and horror because you never knew if it would be a monster or if it would just be a criminal. As far as my writing influences, I think, you know, for someone of my generation, they're pretty standard. Stephen King, Peter Straub, Dean Koontz, anybody, you know, going back into the 70s and the 80s.
I've heard of those guys. They've written some books, right?
A couple here and there.
Yeah, okay. It's good to diversify the experience, right? Read a bunch of stuff from various other places and peoples and stuff.
Absolutely. And before I started reading horror, even though I enjoyed it the Hardy Boys. I enjoyed the classic movies like Frankenstein and Dracula and all of that. I was also very into reading science fiction and mysteries because that's what my father read. So those were the books that were around the house before mm-hmm. I was able to actually go out and start buying my own books. So yeah, Alan Dean Foster, Piers Anthony, James Blish, all of that kind of stuff. The James Bond novels. You know, I read all of that as a kid. So it really gave me a broad horizon for when I started writing.
That was a lot like my reading pattern as well. Piers Anthony, the Magic of Xanth series. Did you ever read Macroscope?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was an awesome messed up book.
Yeah, I was too young at the time to realize that he was probably like tripping madly when he wrote a lot of that stuff.
But man, that guy was prolific.
Yeah, when you get into like college and you look back at it, it's like, oh wow, what was he doing? I want some.
Well, or at least find out how to make it yourself. Yeah. Yeah.
I was a bio major, so I had access to the chem lab.
Ooh, I'm not even going to start with that because I did read that briefly, didn't I? So the biology, biochem lab stuff, does that actually help you do better horror? Is it scary? Is life really scarier than true fiction?
Life
or vice versa?
It's definitely stranger. As far as me using it in my horror, there have been times when I've dipped into science. I think more than anything, as a reader, when I read, it doesn't have to be a horror book either, it can be anything. When you read fiction and they get the science facts blatantly wrong, it really just bugs the hell out of me. And I don't mind it when you're watching like the Sci-Fi Network because you expect it there. But when they're trying to be serious and, you know, they're talking about XYZ snake biting you and your arm rots off and you know in your head, wait a minute, that's a neurotoxic snake, not a hemotoxic snake. Nothing that would ever happen.
I'm giggling like a son of a gun because I have mentioned this to EW, our station manager, before about my all-time worst hated movie of all time, and it's because of the science they use in the movie. Battleship.
Oh, God.
Exactly. Because it's like, no matter how you cut that, the physics in that is like, no, that doesn't work. No, not even close. That... Okay, I can't even eye roll my eyes enough to say that that's wrong.
Yeah, it's you know what? It's a big scale version of when you're watching something in a movie or a TV and somebody gets hit in the head with a lead pipe, but because they're the hero, they just fall down and get right back up again.
Yeah.
I feel like going to all those producers and directors and saying, let me hit you with a lead pipe.
Yeah.
And then you can film it properly.
Yeah. And I mean, it's okay. So you watch a movie like this one that's called Turbo Kid. It's goofy. It's meant to be goofy. It's got no seriousness whatsoever. But it's like, okay, that kind of shtick, cool. No problem. Works for that.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
With science fiction writing, oh crap, I can't remember. It's Harry Harrison, Stainless Steel Rat.
Oh, that's an oldie.
Yeah, well, I'm probably from a similar generation of reading as you are. That's good shtick. I mean, there is no... It's complete cornball science, but he doesn't actually try and get into the hardcore science fiction and explain anything.
Yeah, and you know who was great for that? Was... now, all right, keep going, because I'll remember the name in a second. And he's going to kill me when he sees that I've forgotten his name.
Harlan Ellison. Yes, yes.
I hope he's not listening.
He's probably not listening now, but I'll make sure to send him a copy later.
Yeah, great, great.
Oh, it's all good, clean fun, right?
I'll take some abuse. It's okay.
It's a little bit. It's good for you. Builds character. Puts hair on your chest. At least what they keep telling me. I don't know.
Right, but I mean, his stories, you know, science was just there as a backdrop, and that was perfect, because you knew it wasn't, you know... He wasn't trying to be like some of the other writers and like Greg Bear and really be accurate with their science.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've read a number of other authors and I'm trying to remember the other one. I'm trying to remember who wrote the Grey Lensman series. Ah, crap. Can't remember it. But he never delved into the science either. He just said they made a spaceship engine and it could do that. And that was about as much interest he put into it. Because at the time, who really wanted to know the science?
You know? Yeah, I mean, if it's not pertinent to the story, don't waste time on it.
I mean, exactly.
But don't get it wrong. You know, don't purposely tell us that it's important to the story and get it wrong.
Yes. Oh, they're going to send a virus up to the mothership and crash land the alien spaceship. Okay,
sounds
I believe
like
that. I believe that in a second.
Sure.
Oh, yes, this race of people who are on Krypton who have had the ability to create this planetary intergalactic stuff. And yes, they use fingerprint identification to allow people into their ship. face plant like a son of a gun. Yes, okay. Wardog in the chat room got my author right. It was E.E. Doc Smith. I remember stuff like that, but then I forget about it. So, I mean, you've got a number of novels that you've written, a crap ton of short stories. Do you write your short stories and novels based on, hey, I've got an idea, or, hey, I should be writing something for this?
It all depends. I mean, sometimes a nice anthology comes along and you say, oh, I really want to be part of that. So, you know, you'll try and come up with an idea for it. Other times, you know, ideas can come from anywhere. Song titles, dreams, just snippets of conversation. Sometimes you even, you know, you read a story by somebody and it's like, oh, that was really cool. But what if it happened this way instead? So, you know, I have probably four notebooks full of ideas. There's more there than if I wrote a short story every day for the next 20 years, I wouldn't get through all my notebooks.
Understand. I'm not going to comment much because I don't use the physical notebooks, but I have the same thing in the computer. It's like, yeah, let's throw the stuff out and just like, maybe that's not the idea today, but tomorrow, crap, that'd be the perfect idea.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's good. That's cool. So, I was reading online that you are also a well-entrenched HWA member of stuff and that you were involved with the library programs and the literacy programs.
Yeah. I was going to go back to probably 2011, 2012. I started the library program for the HWA, which initially was just to kind of connect authors and libraries a little bit and let libraries know that there's a lot more horror out there than just the New York Times bestsellers and the other recommended reading lists that they get from, you know, the various publishing houses.
You mean the Stephen Kings?
Not even just the Stephen Kings, but, you know, every year there's maybe 20-25 books that get promoted to libraries from the various publishers as horror or, you know, supernatural. And it's what the publishers think are going to be the big new bestsellers. Mm-hmm. They don't deal at all with the medium size or small press. So if you want to read a Brian Keene or a Michael McBride or a Jeff Strand or something like that, you're not going to find them in a lot of libraries. And that was one of our goals, was just to make libraries informed about this. So we started with just attending a couple of library events, you know, the American Library conferences, and having flyers at a lot of their different events, not even actual physical representation, just paper.
Right.
And it seemed to be striking up a big interest. And what we discovered was, a lot of our members are going out to libraries and doing presentations, and B, a lot of libraries don't have enough horror and they want it, especially in the young adult market. You know, I've had hundreds of librarians tell me they can't keep enough new horror on the shelves to appease their young adult readers. So we've expanded the program. We now have an entire page on our website dedicated just for librarians. So they have access to the Stoker Awards recommendation list as it goes throughout the year. And for them, it's called the recommended reading list. So they see the same list, but without the vote numbers next to it. And they get promotional information sent to them. They get the Stoker finalists and winners. You know, they get that list each year. So they get the press releases. We just did the American Library Conference annual event this year down in Orlando.
I've heard of that one.
Yep, it's big. It's probably close in size to some of the major Comic-Cons. We had 40,000 people in 4 or 5 days.
And is that geared just for like the libraries throughout North America or just the U.S.?
It's definitely North America. I don't know if it's outside of North America or not.
Right.
But yeah, you know, there were people from Canada and Mexico there. We, you know, we put on a presentation. We had a panel discussing horror and we had a booth. So that was a pretty big thing for us. And now we've partnered with United for Libraries, which is an offshoot of the American Library Association. And their goal is just to, as they say, unite authors and libraries. And they have a database of authors. And what we've done through the HWA is get every single one of our members into that database as part of the membership fee that you pay to join. So it's basically a perk for your membership. You're not paying anything extra like people outside the HWA have to.
That's cool. And I didn't know about that.
Yep. So yeah, you're probably in there.
Oh, yay, I'm in there.
So what that means is that libraries that are also members of that can access the database and look up authors in their geographic area by zip code and see who they want to have come in and do presentations or speaking engagements.
Neat. I mean, with our local chapter for the HWA, we talk about the library getting time in front of the library staff or whatever and just trying to set up reading sessions and various little meet and greet type stuff there all the time. So I think it's a good way for authors to promote themselves.
Absolutely.
And I think it's an even better way to try and get good horror, new writing out to people who are using the library system to fixate and feed their particular consumption requirement.
Right. And that's where the literacy part of the program came in. I really started that as an offshoot from our young adult program. And I kind of passed the torch of the young adult on to some other people and focused on the literacy aspect of it. And what we do there is promote horror as a tool to get children and teenagers to read more and to write more. Mm-hmm. Because they love it. In that young adult crowd, dark fiction is the number one genre. And for instance, here in my county, we just worked with 5 libraries on an event to do, I think it was 60 children were chosen as part of a contest from different schools, and they submitted fiction and poetry. And then 3 authors judged it. And now the library consortium in the area has put it out as a book. It's published.
Nice.
But those kids, I mean, just seeing it, their imaginations were amazing.
So why do you think that the horror genre is being such a attraction to the younger audience? I mean, I'm also a comic book guy, so in the old days for me, it was always comic book is a gateway to reading because, oh, you see the pretty pictures, you see the connection between this, that, and the other thing, and then it leads to more the horror stuff. Whoa, sorry.
As far as why, I mean, I don't know if I can answer that any more than I can for why it was so attractive to me at that age. Kids love the thrill. They love to be scared. And as and I said this at the ALA meeting and a couple of other people, Chris Golden and some others, you know, said it as well. Horror encompasses everything. You know, you've got other genres, romance, comedy, Western, science fiction, anything you can think of. They might cross over each other a little bit. You know, you could have romance in a science fiction novel or steampunk or whatever it might be. Horror encompasses everything. You can have horror science fiction, horror westerns, horror anything. And typically, a good horror novel does cross over several genres. Like, for instance, it would be pretty tough to find a horror novel that doesn't have a romantic subplot to it. A lot of them are science fiction. Look at Alien. People mm-hmm. call Alien science fiction, but that's not science fiction. That's horror.
That one, I agree with you 100%.
You know, people say that Frankenstein was the original science fiction novel, but it was also one of the original horror novels. Yep. So horror really, there's something there that appeals to everybody. And you can find your own little niche, whether it's dystopian, zombies, you know, apocalyptic, vampires, comedic horror like Jeff Strand and some other people do. There's something in horror for everybody. The problem is people just don't like to call it horror.
But I would say that in more modern, in the last few years, it's become much more, hey, it's not the ugly stepson anymore. It's actually a given thing that can be somewhat respectable. I mean, it seems to me that a lot more of the literate type storylines, both in movies and TV shows or whatever, starting to take a little bit more ground where, hey, this doesn't have to be the slasher schlock. It can also be a very cool, deep, dark, horribly horrible horror filled storyline like Penny Dreadful. I love the series Penny Dreadful because it's just way out there on the different kinds of aspects it's playing with.
I loved Penny Dreadful too, but there's where you see an interesting dichotomy is that in TV and movies, everyone promotes horror. Horror is big. Horror is huge. But even at ALA when we were there, now it was, there were six of us on the panel. And three of us were from the HWA and three of the other people weren't. And all the people who had new book releases out from the big publishers, the big five, none of those books was called horror, even though they were. And the authors themselves were talking about how they are horror writers and they have written horror books and this book is for horror, but it was not classified by the publishers as horror. It was supernatural thriller. It was paranormal adventure. It was all sorts of different things. Urban fantasy, whatever you might want to call it. They will not label anything horror.
I recall, I can't quite exactly remember what the quote was, but it was somebody saying about the genre classifications for books, stories, anything else, is all of these are created as marketing tools. So you have like these 300 different horror subgenres, each one of them avoiding, as you're calling, the title horror, dark fantasy, urban fantasy, gothic, whatever, and all these other various names, but it actually all means is it's a bit of this and a bit of that.
Exactly. And until, I don't know if you're going to get the publishers to do it or the reading public. You know, I think the reading public still has this phobia about being caught dead reading a horror novel, unless Stephen King is on the cover. Until they get over that, you're going to see the small press horror still languishing and hundreds of authors trying to break through. We got to figure out why. We just need to figure out what that phobia or, you know,
so
cultural bias is. I don't know.
So instead of calling it horror, let's just call it scary shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And that would probably be fine. Just call it, you know, dark fiction. Call it, you know, a supernatural thriller. This is advice to all you authors out there. Don't say horror. When you send in that query letter, you know, to the next agent or the next publisher, just say this is a dark thriller with supernatural overtones.
Oh, there you go. get all the key pop-nop terms into it. I got a kick out of the one called Grimdark, which is what people keep telling me mine is it's Grimdark. It's like, I'm sorry, what? It's poetry. Yeah,
well, if it's dark, it should be grim. I mean, it's not going to be funny grim or funny dark.
Well, there is some of that, but whatever, right? But yeah, no, I just, the whole label thing, it's always, it's kind of screwed with my head when I ever think about it. It's like, I don't care about its label. It's the author who writes good, I'll enjoy the book. Writes crap, I won't enjoy the book.
Exactly. And I want to know who the person out there is that's making all these titles up. All of a sudden, they just pop up.
It's
who started Grimdark?
It's three guys in the little, well, three guys and a girl in this little dark corner room somewhere, and they like just throw these words, and it's like monkeys. They throw them on the screen. It's like, yeah, that one, those works good today.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with that. That's my thing. I think that's it. Yep.
Sounds logical.
Meh. So I'm actually really, one of the things I was really interested in about bringing you on is to talk about YA horror, because as much as I get the concept of younger people getting into horror, I always gravitate to the side that a lot of the horror I tend to watch, see, witness, read, tends to be a little bit on the more excessive side and kind of not what most people try and expose their young adults too. So I'm kind of wondering, it's like, how does YA horror work? I mean, what, how do you shoehorn that into a thing that fits and then also fits not being too extreme? I mean, some of the movies I watch are like, yeah, there's no way you let a kid watch that.
Well, you know, it's funny. YA horror has changed a lot over the last few years. I mean, God, just a few years since I've been writing it. When I first started novel writing, again, you know, 2008 or so, I was speaking to an agent who was big into YA, and I asked her, what's the difference between YA and adult fiction? Because at the time, the novel that I was completing, it seemed to me really to be straddling the line between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how to pitch it when I started sending it to publishers. And she said, it's very simple. In YA, you don't have as much graphic language, and you don't have graphic full-on penetration sex.
Okay. And
I said, all right, that's good to know. So I classified my book as YA, and it told. Now, flash forward, what is it, 6 years, the rules have changed.
No, not changed.
You can curse just as much in YA as you do in adult, and they're even starting to show the full penetration sex, you know, depending on whether it's a real, realistic, you know, urban type.
Yeah.
Fantasy. And if my book was to, that was Carnival of Fear, if it was to come out today, it wouldn't be a YA. It would probably be a new adult simply because of the age of the characters, but it could also still be YA. And in fact, you could even go a little bit lower on the age scale with it than I was telling people back then when I was saying it's 17 and up. I used to use the grade scale of television. You know, YA is a soft R. You can see it on cable, but not necessarily late night Cinemax or HBO. Now you could even see it on, you know, Skinemax.
Okay. I can rock some most of that. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm thinking about it too much in the old school side because the comic book industry, and I come from a lot of comic books, that's why I relate a lot of stuff to comic books, is that you can't do a lot of these things, but oh, now you can. I mean, they won't have pornographic scenes actually showing up in a regular comic book. There are specific adult comics for that that are off the shelves. You don't see them. It's like, oh, it's up on the top shelf where the kids can't see that. But it's just an odd juxtaposition for me as far as my witnessing how that's developing.
But there's a reason for that, and that's because comic books also, they have a broader reading base. So comic books include the middle grades as well as the young adult. Young adult starts at around 14 and up, 15 and up, and then middle grades is 11 to 14 or 11 to 15. So middle grades now is what YA was 15 years ago. I was talking to R.L. Stein about this when we were at the StokerCon in Vegas, and you know, there's no greater authority on middle grade horror than him. He said there's only really two rules that you have to go by for it, and that's that in the story, nobody dies. You can have people die before the story begins, so they could be talking about death. You can have somebody die off screen that's not one of the main characters, but the main characters of the story don't die. And at the end, you have to have a somewhat satisfactory ending. You can't have a bad, terrible ending for the protagonist. Now, he says it doesn't have to be all smiles and goodness. You know, for instance, he had a book where in the end, the boy who was the hero of the story, he was able to defeat the werewolf that was bothering everybody in the town. But in the process, he got bit. So he didn't die, but he's got some problems that he's going to have to face down the road. And that's okay, as long as you don't have a sad, depressing ending for the hero. You know, young kids want to have, they want to know that something positive is going to happen in the future. And that's really, you know, where you see the difference between middle grades, young adult, and adult horror. The middle grades, they want positive looking forward, because they're still afraid of a lot of things. You know, they're still worrying about what's under the bed or what's in the closet. And they need some security at the end of the story. For the young adult, everything is about coming of age, becoming that adult, knowing that those old fears that they left behind are gone, but now there's new fears and they're much more real. And it might have to do with being ostracized. It might have to do with losing your virginity. It might have to do with rape, violence, you know, domestic violence, crime. You can put all of those things, anything that teens deal with in real life, you can work into a YA novel. And really the best way to determine if you've gone too far or not far enough, spend some time with teens. See what they talk about. See what they're afraid of and what they're interested in. And fiction and comic books and movies are three really different things when it comes to what you should and should be not be doing.
That is some interesting stuff, which a number of people in the chat room are saying, hey, that guy knows his stuff. I'm agreeing with it. It's because that's a completely interesting, different view for me on how that works. I've never, like, I personally don't think about YA writing myself, because I know it's a growth market for a lot of authors who are trying to break it, make it, do whatever it is they're going to. It's just I've never myself considered looking at it. But you've kind of put it into a perspective that says, huh, I could do some stuff like that, and that might actually work. So, I mean, just an odd thing. Don't mind me. I sometimes go off on a tangent that just has absolutely nothing to do with anything else. Like, I'm going to throw out the name Amber Benson.
Oh, I love Amber.
Who doesn't love Amber?
She is a hoot.
So, I see that you did some partnerships with her in regards to some literacy promotion, and I'm guessing some YA stuff, adult readers, young adult readers and stuff?
Well, at the Stoker Awards a few years ago, she and I presented the award for young adult horror. Amber, I don't know, a lot of people might not realize it because they just know her from Buffy and from the movies. Amber writes young adult and new adult fiction. She's probably got, I'm going to, off the top of my head, between her novels and the ones that she's co-written with Christopher Golden, she's probably got like 7 novels out there. And they're good. She's a really good writer. So she was the guest of honor that year. So she and I presented the YA Award. And then, you know, we got to talking, and I interviewed her for our newsletter, and we worked on some promotions for the literacy program together. Hopefully someday we'll work on some more, but her schedule is a bit more busy than mine is. So sometimes trying to get people, you know, back into these things is a little tough.
Uh-huh. And I'm just reading her wiki saying that she's worked with one of the artists that I actually really like, Ashley Wood, on something called Shadow Play. And that's like, ooh, that's cool. I may have to look that up now.
Yeah, I mean, she, besides books and TV, she's done some radio work. She's done some comic book work, and she's done podcasts, and even worked on some, I guess you could say, direct to internet short films.
Oh yeah,
in the science fiction and horror genres.
Cool. I knew she had some books out. I just never actually had the opportunity to read any of them. But yeah, I also just know her mostly from Buffy as well. So, but I threw that out because it's like, hey, that's a neat connection.
Yeah. So yeah, that's one of the great things about being a writer is when you get to meet some of these people who, you know, it's just like you want to go all fanboy, but you can't. So you have to remain really cool and just be like, hey, how you doing?
Yeah, it's like, hey, how do you think this is going? It's going good. Where are we? Oh, yeah, that's pretty. Yeah, we should probably talk about that because that's awesome kind of stuff. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Did the same thing. I'm a zombie guy, so it's like meeting George Romero at Fan Expo last year. It's like, hey, how's it going? And that was it. It's not a big, hey, man, biggest fan. It's
right.
Yeah.
But then you go home and you do the happy dance.
It's like, I shook George's hand. It's like, oh, it's like, yeah, I'll watch that. I'm not going to worry about that. Yeah, no, I see some people do that because I've been to a couple of conventions where it's like, well, I'm so afraid to approach him. It's like, well, he's sitting there right there so that you can approach him. Go up and talk to him. Don't be afraid. Don't be shy. That's what they're there for. They're out to meet people and stuff. I think it's always amusing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But what do you think the future of YA? I mean, this is obviously from what you've explained, and it's actually clearer to me now, that the sliding scale for what YA horror stands for nowadays, it seems to be getting into a little bit more, everything's more permittable. How do you think that's going in the future? I mean, do you think it's going to continue going that way, or is it going to change, or do you think it's going to like slide up differently?
I think you're always going to see stuff promoted as YA versus adult. I think possibly the whole new adult subgenre is going to eventually just blend back into both of those again. Mm-hmm. As far as YA content, eventually, really the only difference is going to be that the age of the protagonists in the story and the fact that a lot of YA still, despite adding in the sex and the violence and the language and everything else, it's still going to be a lot of coming of age stories because that's what that generation is always going to be about. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about that is that 16-year-old kid, it doesn't matter if it's today or 30 years from now, if they pick up, I don't know, Salem's Lot, if they pick up, you know, my YA, not my last one, Ghosts of Coronado Bay, if they pick up Harry Potter, if they pick up, you know, Divergent, any of these books, it's still going to strike a chord with them because deep down at the very, very heart of it, it's all about coming of age and trying to straddle that line between child and adult and just being confused as hell about it and full of, you know, crazy hormones and people want you to act one way and your friends want you to act another, and it's just a confusing time.
Now you've given me a reason to sort of be liking of Harry Potter. I never really got into the Harry Potter shtick, but then I guess being the old fart that I am, trying to read that stuff is like, I don't really get this because this is not the way I read fantasy or horror or science fiction when I was a kid. I was thrown full tilt into the, hey, let's start with a Divine Comedy. Okay.
Well, you know what? We had YA is our age and even further than back, Lord of the Flies. That's YA.
That was a mean novel.
But it was YA. Remember the movie The Outsiders?
Yep.
That book was YA.
Animal House classed as YA?
That would be considered new adult now.
Ah, oh, geez, man. All animals are created equal. Some animals are more equal than others. I always remember that shtick in the thing. Yeah. Well, I guess it's like any genre, really, right? It keeps shifting. I mean, science fiction keeps going through the changes all the time. It's trying to be very dark and gritty and scary, and then it comes into the shtick of, oh, look, we got big robots hurting big monsters and stuff, and then it goes back to other, hey, look, we're splicing with DNA, grafting, and all this other stuff, and it's like, okay, it keeps moving.
Well, you know, you see it in science fiction, you see it in horror, not so much in the other genres like mysteries or thrillers, that something becomes popular and everyone and their mother jumps on the bandwagon. So you could have zombies for 10 years or vampires for 10 years. You could have, like you said, robots or hard science fiction versus, you know, fantasy science fiction. And then after a while, people get sick of reading that stuff over and over and over again. They want something else. Or maybe the fans of the other types of science fiction or horror, they feel left out. So they stop buying the one kind and they start buying that rare book. You know, if everyone's buying vampires, well, all of a sudden people get sick of it, you might just start buying those ghost stories that have been languishing on the shelves, you know, and not selling for 20 years. Let's go back and read all of those now. And then everybody starts writing ghost stories.
Yes. And yeah, that tends to be what the big five like to do as well. It's like, hey, that was popular. Give me five more like that and we'll push that through.
Yeah. Yep. And then it's the author's fault when after 4 years it stops selling.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, your book sucks. What? Yeah, it's because you didn't do anything. Okay. Yeah. No, it's like the zombie craze to me is awesome. Like, I've been a zombie fan for ages, but I still don't understand why it's still so popular.
I can understand the popularity of zombies if it wasn't all the same. And I know it's not. I mean, there's different types of zombies out there, but the majority of it are the shamblers.
Yeah.
You know, and you got to blame, you know, The Walking Dead for that.
Yes.
They just made it too popular at a time when it was finally starting to branch out into all different kinds of zombies. Now, all of a sudden, it sunk back into the 1960s style zombie. Which, you know, great if you've got some like that and some other kinds. Like, I've written, probably 6 or 7 zombie short stories. And in my book, Cemetery Club, there are some zombies. Also, yeah. And I've never once in all of those used shambling zombies. I had all different kinds.
Cool.
The only time I used the real traditional zombie was when I did Carnival of Fear, because I was purposely recreating the whole scene from Return of the Living Dead.
Yep.
When they were in the shopping mall.
Yep.
Okay, I was doing a twist on that, so I had to have the shamblers. But it's only one chapter in a book.
Yeah, okay.
you know, for like my short story and even the stuff about zombies that I like to read, I want to see a different take on it.
I will give you a different take on a zombie if you get a movie. It's called Pontypool.
I've heard of it. I haven't had a chance to see it yet.
It's about zombie infection by noise. Actually, by language, by talking. The concept is awesome as hell. So I'm not trying to toot the zombie horn because, well, I like the zombie horn, but there are a lot of zombie-type stories out there, and you're right. The baseline has always been back to the Romero Shamblers and The Walking Dead continuing that. So I still like that, though.
Well, I mean, the new issue of Cemetery Dance that's coming out either this month or next month, it's hard to pin them down to a publication. I've got a story in there that, I mean, at its heart, is a zombie story. It's not your traditional zombie. They're not dead, but they are zombies.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, you know, for me, it was odd because it wasn't until I finished it that I realized it was a zombie story.
So more like the original, real traditional zombie story like Voodoo?
No, it's more like a religious cult type zombie story, but
okay,
with a physical change, you know, an actual physiological difference thrown
right
in. I don't want to give too much away.
Well, exactly. You want them to buy the stories, right?
Right. But if you like stories about cults and you like stories about zombies, you're going to like this one.
Excellent. Now, I understand you have a book out coming out and recently out or recently coming out. I remember you posting something about that.
Oh no, I finished a science fiction, a teen, you know, YA science fiction novel.
Okay.
And before I started sending it to publishers, I decided to try an experiment and I did the Amazon Prime.
Right.
Not Amazon Prime, Amazon Scout.
Let's talk about that for a bit.
It didn't win, so now I'm shopping it around.
Okay. Oh, I heard that. All right. I don't know what the Scout program is for Amazon.
It's an interesting thing. You have to set up the book as if you were going to self-publish it. So mm-hmm. The book has to be complete and edited, and you have to have a professional cover. And the excerpt and, you know, back cover information and all that kind of thing. And then you post all of that to the special Amazon Scout page. And if you get accepted into the program, then what they do is they run a 30-day promo for it where people come and read the first chapter. And if they like the first chapter, they vote for the book. If you get enough votes, then the book goes to the Amazon editing team. And they decide if they want to purchase it and publish it.
Okay.
So I made it all the way to the Amazon editors, and they didn't purchase it. It's not great, but I don't feel too bad because they take something like 2 out of every 100 books or something each month. So
nice.
We'll see what we do with it from now. But it is an interesting program, and a lot of writers are trying it. So, you know. Basically, it's just like going to a traditional publisher and going through the slush pile and making it to the editor and then either getting accepted or not accepted. The only difference being that Amazon is the publisher and you have to have the cover and book ready for them. They won't do any editing.
You do all the work and they say, okay, we like that. Okay, no, we don't.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
But they pay pretty good.
Oh, so well, that's the main thing, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, sorry, I actually had a complete thought there that went somewhere else. My bad. I'm going to try and cover it back. No, that's not. It's gone. So, being a writer, I mean, the whole rejection process, this segues well into that particular thing. Got to have thick skin, right? Thick skin.
Very, very thick skin. Thick skin because you're going to spend most of your life getting criticized and rejected.
And trolled on social media and held up to, you should be better. It's like, why? They aren't.
Exactly.
So, I mean, do you, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but it's not all bad, you know. A lot of it just bounces right off.
Yeah, exactly. So, do you use a lot of social media, that sort of thing, to keep your fingers out and the stuff going and keep the whole promotion of what's going on, what's going on?
I'm on all of the standard platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram. I'm probably on Facebook way more than I should be. It is, you know, a huge time suck.
No.
I try to, you know, balance what I talk about in social media between promotion and just things that are fun and interesting. Very rarely do I post anything political or anything blatantly obnoxious. It's more just a lot of sarcastic humor.
Yeah, and that usually is a good thing as far as I've seen. It's like, yeah, just post stuff.
Right.
Don't post, buy my book! Well, once in a while, that's fine, but don't do it like every 30 minutes.
Exactly.
Those guys make me laugh like you wouldn't believe. Yeah, I'll hide you for now. You can be a number, but I won't see your posts anymore.
Yeah, I find I hide more and more things these days. I've discovered that the I don't want to see this post or others like it button is really, really nice. So now for the last week, my feed has had no political posts, and it's had nothing about Pokemon, and it's had nothing like that. It's just been the stuff I want to see.
Pokemon. That thing is insane.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, I'm not even going to designate it with anything more information-wise. So, I mean, do you do any conventions? Do you have any appearances coming up?
Well, not until September. I did the StokerCon in May.
Right.
And I did American Library Association in June. And in September, at the end of September, I will be up near Syracuse doing ScareCon.
Oh, I've heard of that one.
Yeah, it's fun. It's not big, but they get a lot of big, I don't want to say, I shouldn't say big stars. They get a lot of big B-movie and C-movie stars.
The fun people.
I'll be rubbing elbows with people like Robbie Benson and C. Thomas Howell.
Yeah.
We're not going to get probably anyone from like The Walking Dead or anything like that there. But it's a fun little convention. I go up there and I share a table with Patrick Freewald. He's another horror writer.
Nice.
And we're part of a little beta readers group. So we've known each other for a long time. And basically we just hang out and promote horror and our books. And then at night we have hamburgers and beer and bullshit.
Yeah. That's what life's about, right?
Yeah. It's a fun little thing. No
hamburgers
pressure.
And beers and bullshit. I love it. So, my listeners are familiar with StokerCon because I've talked about it a couple times with a number of people. What was, because StokerCon this year was the first one that's been put through and it's part of a ongoing new regular series. How did you find StokerCon this year?
I loved everything except the hotel. And that's not the fault of StokerCon or anything like that. That's just Las Vegas in general. They'll rip you off whenever they can.
Yeah.
The StokerCon event itself went off very, very smoothly, especially for a first one. And, you know, without sounding obnoxious or anything else, we kind of blew the doors off World Horror, which was nice. It shows that we have the goods to keep going with this as an event for years to come. And personally, it was great for me because I got to set, I guess, a few personal milestones, cross things off my bucket list. I got to interview R.L. Stine.
Nice.
Which was tremendous fun. I put on a panel about beta readers, which we had also done the previous year at World Horror, and it went off great, and it went off just as well this year. Everyone loved it. And then I got to be on two other panels. And let's see, what else? Well, I didn't win the award. I was up for novel, you know, best achievement in a novel. I didn't win, but it was great to be nominated and hang out with everybody at the banquet.
Yes.
So, all in all, it was a good time.
Excellent. And next year, the StokerCon is, as I understand it, on the Queen Mary?
The Haunted Queen Mary.
The Haunted Queen Mary. And yes. I'm actually, there's a possibility I might go to that one just because that might be a better time of the year for me. But I'm looking forward to the idea.
It's going to be a lot of fun, I think. If people aren't aware of it, George R.R. Martin is going to be there as the guest of honor. And I'm not going to let anything out of the bag, but it is entirely possible that some of us just may lock him in a stateroom and not let him out until he finishes the next Game of Thrones book.
So I'm assuming you're a fan?
Actually, believe it or not, I haven't read any of the books. I'm a fan of George Martin's. I've read a lot of his other stuff.
Yep.
But for some reason, the timing of when Game of Thrones came out, I don't know what I was doing or how I missed getting caught up in it. When the show came out and I started watching it, I fell in love with it. And then found out very quickly that the show was not following the books at all.
Well, not closely. Not even close, yeah.
Right. So what I've decided is that I'm not going to read the books until the show is over. So then I can look at it and not trying to be following both of them at the same time.
Yeah, that's probably a good plan. I read some of them when I was much younger, completely forgot all of them, and then watched basically the last six seasons in the last 2 months. It's like, I'm binging this crap out of this show because it's, oh, this is much better. Oh, okay, let's go. Keep going. Yep. So every weekend was a season sort of thing.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. It was fun. Yeah, I heard that George, so I'm guessing you read Wild Cards then, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a fun series.
Going back probably, again, way beyond what a lot of our listeners are going to remember, the first thing I read by George Martin was Fever Dream.
Oh, I remember that one. Vaguely. Yep. Vaguely.
A very Southern Gothic style vampire novel.
Nice.
It was great.
Okay.
That got me hooked on him. And, you know, and I found him because of reading science fiction at the time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's basically 2 minutes to the end of the show. I mean, how would you like people to stalk you?
Probably with their arms filled with beer and tacos. I don't know.
Taco Tuesday. That's coming up.
Again, you can find me in all the usual places, Facebook, Twitter. It's JG Faraday at anywhere you want to look. Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram. It's all the same name, JG Faraday. And you can go to my website, which is jgfaraday.com. And that also links to my blog, which I'm not going to confuse people with by adding even more titles in there. So you can just find it right there on the website. And I do a lot of interviews with other people rather than posting a lot of stuff about myself on the blog. So if you don't want to hear about me, you can still find some interesting things there. And as far as promoting myself right now, like I said, I've got a new story coming out in the next issue of Cemetery Dance.
Nice.
And after that, I've got a couple of more short stories coming out during the year. And I have no idea what the publication dates are for them yet, so I can't even promote them. But they will be promoted on my Facebook page as soon as I find out.
Awesome. Well, it's been great having you on the show. Appreciate it tremendously, you coming on.
And thank you for having me. It's been fun.
That's what we're all about here in the Zombie After Rot show. Everybody in the chat room, on the streams, everybody else listening everywhere else, have yourselves an amazing time. It's been great seeing you, great knowing you. Follow the Afterrod on the Twitter, Facebook, and all that other stuff. Have yourself an amazing time.
Of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their picnic.